Okay, welcome back. This is Rabbi Jeff Sachs of Atid and Web Yeshiva, with what hopefully is, I mean, not hopefully, it definitely is going to be the final installment of the fourth chapter of the Shmona Prakim, bringing us up to the halfway mark, I suppose, the very long fourth chapter. And then I really just want to summarize what we've done here and then move on to the fifth chapter. Let me just take a quick look to see who's online with us. Okay, welcome, welcome, welcome. Okay. Chani Greenberg, where are you located? I don't recall. I'm not sure if you've been in the class before or not. I just your name seems new to me. So just you can chat in where you're located. And everybody else, if you have a webcam, please hit the send video button on the video panel. No one seems to be sending video. What a shame. Yerushalayim. Okay, wonderful. The Rambam, in discussing the hard work of perfecting one's midot, of perfecting one's personality traits, discussed the golden mean, finding balance, trying to find the middle path or the middle way. Between all of the different personality traits, so that you can reach equilibrium between any of the extremes, none of which are good. And then, almost as an aside, he admits here at the end that Yetzanu mekavanat haperek, we've gone off track, but in the process of going off track, we have explicated one of the real mysteries of the Torah, the question of Eze chet chata, what did Moshe sin? What was Moshe's flaw that he was punished, that he could not go into Eretz Yisrael? And the Rambam essentially says that Moshe's sin was anger. Now, this is significant for a few reasons. One is the Rambam, both here as well as in Hilchot Deot, has held up anger as a particularly negative trait. We spoke about it at some length a number of weeks ago. Why anger is particularly bad. It will resonate with ideas that are going to come about in the coming chapter. So I'll just take a moment to review that. But if perfecting one's personality traits, if perfecting one's character, both his intellectual character and his moral character, which the Rambam was careful to differentiate the two. If that's the task of the religious life, if that's the task of a person in this world, there are certain bad traits which counter that goal. And then there are certain bad traits that not only are you working in the wrong direction, but you're really undermining everything altogether. Anger and arrogance, which was not Moshe's problem whatsoever. On the contrary, Moshe was described as being the most anti-arrogant person, the most humble of all people. But anger is particularly dangerous because it is the thing which can really throw the entire operation off kilter. In various metaphors that we've used to describe the balancing act, the very delicate balancing act that's needed to keep all of your personality traits in order, anger is the one, together with arrogance, but here we're talking about anger in the context of Moshe, anger is the one that can really impede the kind of fine-tuning that's necessary. Now, to be clear, for Moshe, the kind of anger he showed, he didn't kick and scream and smash plates and jump up and down and do all types of other things that people do sometimes when they get angry. I don't know, maybe he raised his voice a little, or perhaps he used a harsher term when a more gentler term might have been used. That seems to be what the Rambam was saying as the people were complaining for water. Last time we mentioned that the Rambam points out that the people's complaint for water in Bamidbar in Perek in Parshat Chukat, the people's complaint for water was legitimate. It was a legitimate request. It was a legitimate complaint. You're in the desert. You don't have water to drink. This is going to be a problem. So even God Himself, who tells Moshe, "Speak to the rock, and the water will come out," admits that it's not an illegitimate request, and that Moshe's response, somewhat harsh, is the anger. So, look, I don't know how many of you have children, or how many of you currently have small children. I've often resorted to parenting as an example here, because it's really, although there are other examples to be sure, but parenting can sometimes really be a relationship, a scenario, a task that really tests one's midot. It's not like another job where, you get up in the morning and you go to work and you like it or you don't like it, or you like it more, or you like it less, and the 5 o'clock whistle is going to come and you'll be gone. Parenting is really 24/7, even though, sometimes you leave the house, and the demands on one's, not only one's time and resources, but on your whole person, to always be on and to always try to be the best you can be, not just because you want to be an example for your children, but because you want to, the nature of this relationship is such that you're sometimes tested. I'm not talking about when children rebel, although that certainly would be the case, but even in the garden variety day-to-day encounters, how one speaks to his or her children, how one responds to the many demands that are put on him or her by one's children, either when they're small or when they're older, and that resonates here a little bit as well. Moshe as a kind of parent, indeed, in Parshat Baalotcha, Moshe is compared to, of all things, to a nursing mother. Moshe asks God, am I supposed to be a nursing mother to these people? Nursing mother meaning, a stage of parenting which is usually experienced by and suffered by the mother, where literally you're just tied to the child, where the child's every need has to be responded to. And God's answer essentially in Parshat Baalotcha to Moshe is yes, that's precisely what these people need at this stage in their history. And that kind of demands that are put on one are such that everything has to be viewed under a kind of microscope. And every reaction, not that every cross word with a child is going to destroy their life, thank God for that. I at least can say thank God for that. Children, Baruch Hashem, are a little more resilient than that. But that one need be very conscious. And one gets the impression that that's the scenario that Moshe is in. It's like to go back to our metaphor of the scales, not the seesaw, but like the scales, the mosnayim, the measuring scales, the pans of justice, where, like the Rambam's metaphor of the pans being in the Rambam in Hilchot Teshuva, that the pans are in equilibrium, and if you do one minor deed, like the weight of a feather, it's going to tip in one direction. So imagine an even more precise measure, a very, very finely calibrated digital, whatever the fanciest, in laboratories today, whatever the fanciest type of scales. I remember when I was in high school, the last time I studied science thoroughly in college, I really didn't do too much of the hard sciences, but I remember in lab in high school, this is going back a ways, you'd have to measure things, particularly in chemistry, And we had one of those old types of scales with weights, you know, with actual weights, you know, a 10-gram weight, a 5-gram weight, a 1-gram weight, a half a gram weight. You'd have to put it onto the pan to balance it out. And even then, I remember thinking, this has got to be somehow imprecise. Now I imagine they have, you know, even like simple kitchen scales today are digital and measure things out to the 10th or to the 100th decimal point very, very, very precisely. And it accounts for the weight. You can account for the weight of the dish that the flour or that the sugar or whatever it is that you're weighing in. So imagine in real scientific laboratories, imagine in the pharmaceutical companies that are doing drug research, imagine the kind of very, 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 very precise scales that they must be using. That's Moshe Rabbeinu. It's the difference between that scale at, what's the name of the big pharmaceutical company? Someone help me out. No? I don't know. One of those big pharmaceutical companies. Anyone. Are you there? Pfizer. Okay. So imagine the scale that they use in the laboratory in Pfizer versus the bathroom scale that I have upstairs, which starts off being not calibrated and can only measure things, you know, more or less to round it off to the kilogram. So it's perfectly effective for, you know, measuring myself and checking to see how much weight I've gained or less so lost. But, you know, it's a scale. We would still call it a scale. I mean, it still more or less does the job. And for most people, that's all you really need is that kind of bathroom scale. But for Moshe Rabbeinu is a personality that is so highly refined and so nearing perfection that the slightest error is going to register in a way that a less precise instrument is going to ignore. You put a feather onto my bathroom scale and it won't do anything. It won't register any movement whatsoever. And for most of us, you know, we round up, we round down. That's the extent of the degree to which we can say that our personalities are in fine tune. Moshe Rabbeinu is not like that. He is like the finestly, most delicately calibrated instrument. And for him, the weight of a feather is enough to tip the scale. It's not merely a case of the bigger they are, the harder they fall, which it's certainly, you know, in the case of Moshe, it's certainly true that that's the case. But it's also a sense that the more refined, the more calibrated. We spoke about the personality being like a radio receiver of the old sort, where you have to manually focus in or manually adjust the dial to get a clearer transmission. A clear to tune in, rather. So that's Moshe Rabbeinu. It's a much more finely calibrated, the personality with a Navi, with a prophet, and with Moshe certainly is much more finely calculated. And I think that's the point that the Rambam is making here in this otherwise parenthetical remark. But it also now introduces something that we're going to address in the fifth chapter. And that is our task as beings who are commanded to attempt, at least to attempt, to know God. And knowledge of God comes through various channels. One of them, ultimately, although none of us, I imagine, I think I can speak for all of us here, none of us have yet reached it. Maybe one day some of us will, please God. And that is prophecy, nivuah. that if one's personality is sufficiently attuned, you can become a receiver, again, using that metaphor of the radio or the television, for the divine broadcast, which is prophecy. And that's the connection, although the Rambam doesn't spell out the connection. That's the connection between everything he discussed in this lengthy fourth chapter, this concluding side point about Moshe Rabbeinu, and now moving on to the fifth chapter, which is the necessity to strive to know God. There's a concluding paragraph in which the Rambam summarizes everything in the fourth chapter. I'm gonna skip it for now. But I, of course, encourage you all to read on your own. The Rambam in the fifth chapter, which is called B'Shimush HaNefesh LeTachlit Achat, the use of the soul's capacities, the soul's powers, the soul's energies towards one purpose, and that one purpose is to acquire knowledge of God. Now, let's just, by way of introduction to this topic, let's look at two sources from the Mishneh Torah, in which the Rambam discusses from different angles this question of the degree to which we can know God, the degree to which we can come into an intimate type of knowledge with him. In Hilchot Tshuva, and this is out of order, Hilchot Tshuva, the very end of the Sefer Mada. Again, remember, the Mishneh Torah is divided into 14 books. Into 14 books. That's why it's sometimes called the Yad HaChazaka, Yad being. What did I do there? Yad being the Rashi Tevot, the gematria for 14. The first of the 14 books is the Sefer Mada, the book of wisdom or the book of knowledge. What kind of knowledge? Well, essentially the knowledge of God. The entire book ends, the entire volume, the entire section. The Sefer Mada, the great philosophic work, the work which actually caused some problems for the Rambam, as we've discussed in the past, because for the first time, really, somebody wrote a halachic work that was synthesized together with larger philosophical analysis. And this was disturbing to some. And for this, the Rambam was criticized by some. But the end of the Sefer Mada, the end of the Sefer Mada is Hilchot Teshuvah, which we talk about Rosh Hashanah time, Yom Kippur time, how to repair yourself. It echoes some of what we've discussed in the Shmona Prakim, but more from a reparative point of view. That if you've sinned, how do you go about repairing yourself? The Shmona Prakim doesn't take sin as its starting point. It doesn't take chet as its starting point. It takes status quo as its starting point and a question of how do you move from neutral to perfection. So the end of the Hilchot Teshuvah, this is the very last halacha. It's the last halacha of the Hilchot Teshuvah, and it's the last halacha and serves as a summary for the entirety of the Sefer Mada. Davar yadua uvarur. It is well known, says the Rambam, she'en avat HaKadosh Baruch Hu Nikshert belibo shel Adam ad sheyishgeba tamid. That the love of God, the entire 10th chapter of Hilchot Teshuvah deals with the nature of and the acquisition of the love of God. That the love of God cannot be acquired in one's heart until a person is infatuated with God constantly. V'yazov kol ma sheba'olam chutz mimena. And will ignore everything in the world except for the love of God. Now, I don't think the Rambam means what you may mistakenly think that means. He's not talking about going off to a convent and spending the whole day, you know, just thinking about God. In order to abandon everything except the love of God means to embrace all types of things that are very much related to this world. What does it mean, like we say in Shema, to love God with all your heart, with all your soul? You can't love God except for, or except with, the degree of knowledge you possess of him. And according to the quantity of your knowledge of God, your love of God will be in direct proportion. Im ma'at ma'at v'im harbe harbe. If you only know him a little bit, you can only love him a little bit. And if you know him a lot, you can love him a lot. To know him is to love him. Lefichach tzarech ha'adam liyached atzmo lehavinu lehaskil b'chochmot v'tfunot ha'modiim lo. And therefore, a person has to dedicate himself to acquiring knowledge and wisdom and understanding of the things that will inform him of how God is and how he works. So that is the task of a person. Here the Rambam clearly says you have to, since we are commanded to love God, to utterly love him with all our heart, with all our soul, with all our might. We're not talking about some kind of high school crush. We're talking about the real thing. And that only comes about through knowledge. That knowledge is the real source of, love. It's different than infatuation. And again, to compare it as Chazal did, as Shir HaShirim does, to compare it to romantic love. There's the love of puppy love, of infatuation, of a teenage crush, and then there's the depth and richness and profundity of a love that comes about through a lifetime of shared experience, of you know, knowing one another. Often we're talking here, of course, about husband and wife, although there might be other relationships where this is also true, parent-child friendships, really profound, deep friendships, where once you spend the amount of time necessary to really, really understand someone, to really appreciate them, to really know who they are and how they work and how they think and how they feel and what they believe, that's a different kind of love. It's a much deeper, it's a much more profound love. That's what the Rambam is saying about the love of God. Earlier, in the first chapter of the Sefer Mada, in Perek Aleph Halacha Yud of Hilchot Yesodei HaTorah, the Rambam had said, Mahu zeh shebikesh Moshe Rabbeinu lahasig, kesh amar, Hareini na et kvodecha. Hareini na et kvodecha. Moshe Rabbeinu, After the Chet Ha'egel, after the sin of the golden calf, Moshe Rabbeinu asks God that God should reveal himself. Show me your glory, asks Moshe of Hashem. So what was he asking exactly? What did he want to know? Bikesh leida abitat himatz'o shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Ad shiye yadua b'libo kemo yediat echad min ha'anashim shera'a panav. V'nechkakat surato b'libo. So what does it mean? Moshe says, asks God, show me your kavod, show me your glory. So does it mean that Hashem, that Moshe really thought Hashem would show himself, would reveal his face to him, literally? Well, obviously not, because God doesn't have a face, neither does he have a hand, neither does he have a nose, even though metaphorically we sometimes speak of him in those ways. Dibra Torah b'lashon k'lashon b'nei Adam. The Torah speaks metaphorically about God, as if sometimes he had physicality. But obviously he does not. This is, of course, one of the important themes, the opening theme of the Mor Nevuchim, of the Guide to the Perplexed, how the language of the Torah works, particularly in this regard, particularly regarding God's corporeality, of which he has none. God doesn't have a body. So what exactly was Moshe asking for when he wanted God to reveal himself? So he said he wanted to understand him in the same way that we know and recognize one of the people, the person that sits in the cubicle next to you, so that when you see him, you know that's Fred and that's Sam, that your face, that the Shira'a Panav v'nechkat Surato, it's like a thumbprint, the way that some people have like electric cards. It knows that it's you. Like when you go into work, you have to swipe your card on the card reader, and it knows that you got there at 9:02 and you left at 4:58, and somehow you came 2 minutes late and you left 2 minutes early, and we know exactly what you were doing all the time and how many pages you printed out from the printer and all the other types of things that the modern office might want to track. That thumbprint, that card reader, that knowledge that we have when we look at someone and they're, they, I mean, it's actually an amazing thing, the ability to look at someone's face and to keep in your head a catalog of thousands of faces and the associations you can make. Oliver Sacks, the great neurologist and author, no relation to me, he spells it differently. Oliver Sacks, I think, just wrote a book. His most recent book is about this, that disorder that some people have that he himself suffers from. It's very interesting, where you can't recognize someone by their face. But for everyone else, for the overwhelming majority of the population that don't suffer from that, I forget what that disability is. Is Alan on with us? Where's Alan? Alan is not on with us. Alan usually serves the job of teacher's assistant. Whenever I say anything, he'll quickly Google it and put it up in the chat. But maybe Tehillah Leah can help us out. She likes to do those kinds of things also. I forget the name of this book of Oliver Sacks. Sacks, Sacks. And that particular disorder where you can't recognize a face. But for everyone else, a face is like a thumbprint that you can read. Now, we can't read thumbprints. I can't look at my thumb or your thumb and read them. Maybe like certain police detectives can. But we all do it with each other's faces. And if you had webcams and you'd hit send video, it would be very helpful, precisely because of this. Because when you teach and when you learn and when you study together, the ability to see the face is a very deep, it's a very deep experience. It helps people. That's why it helps people connect. So that kind of knowledge that I see your face and I know that's you, that's the kind of knowledge, that's the kind of intimacy that Moshe was asking for. I'll tell you a funny story. I'll tell you. No, I'm not referring to Tehillah. That's his one. I think is one of his earliest books, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. That's a different disorder. But there's a more recent. But you sent me his. I don't know, maybe it's this one, The Mind's Eye. His most recent book. His most recent book was called The Mind's Eye. There must be an essay in there that I had read that's about this topic. Yeah, but it's the same person. That's the author, Oliver Sacks, Sacks. is a wonderful writer if you're interested in science writing or in medical writing, etc. I mean, I'll tell you something. I see Joel is on. His camera's not on. I hope he's feeling well. You all know that last week we went to go visit our friend Joel Nowicki up there in Poland. And you know, Joel and I have been we've been learning together for a long time. He's been on with us on Web Yeshiva for a long time, and because I can see his face, because I know what he looks like, not just from a picture, but there he is. He just turned on his video camera. You know, one you get that sense that you know him. And I walked into his house last Sunday, and well, we'd actually never met. We'd actually never even been on the same continent at the same time. But I know him. I feel that I, in a way that I, you don't feel that you know someone. When I was a kid, I had a pen pal. I had a pen pal who we used to write letters, like the real kind of letters. You know, there was some organization that set kids up with pen pals from other places, and you know, and you'd write letters. And at some point, I think you even exchanged photographs. But it's not the same thing. It's not the same kind of knowledge as you have from, you know, from the live face. So it was an odd experience to walk into his house, and to meet him in the flesh, as it were. When you feel that you already know someone, even though you've never actually technically met, at least in that old way. So when Moshe asks to know God, when Moshe asks to know God, Joel agrees. When Moshe asks to know God, he wants that kind of knowledge. He wants to know God with the intimacy that you have from knowing someone face to face, even though obviously it's a metaphorical request. Kach bikesh Moshe Rabbeinu liot mitziut HaKadosh Baruch Hu nifredet belibo mishar hanimtzim ad sheyedea mitat himatzo kaasher hi. והשיבו ברוך הוא שאין כוח בדעת האדם החי שהוא מחובר מגוף ונפש להשיג אמיתת דבר זה על בוריו. And God's answer was, you can never get it 100%. Because we have a problem. We are this weird kind of synthesis, a shatnez between Guf and nefesh, between spiritual or between physical and spiritual, between body and soul, this disparate kind of entrapment of the completely ephemeral in the concrete body, almost the prison of the body that we have. Of Aaron Soloveitchik, Zichron Levracha, Zechet Tzadik Levracha, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik's younger brother, sometime in the 1980s or so, I think in the late 1980s, he suffered a stroke. And he lived for, I think, many years afterwards. But he always suffered the results of the stroke, which left him physically disabled and partially paralyzed. And while he was recovering from the stroke, I think even while he was in the hospital, he wrote an essay, which may be online. If I can find it, I will try to Google it as we speak, called I'll have to send it to you. The title escapes me, but he develops the idea that since his body was no longer responding to, since his body was no longer responding to the commands. In other words, the stroke hit him and it left his left side paralyzed. Let's say, so he said, the mind thinks, and it can lift the right hand, and the mind thinks, and the left hand doesn't respond anymore. And it heightened for him this notion that the soul, the animus, the ghost in the machine, whatever it is that we are inside, is really entrapped inside the body. And we don't think of it because normally the two are functioning hand in glove or soul in hand, as it were. But only when something goes haywire do you notice the disconnect between the two. Because that's who we are, because we are trapped here, because our minds are encased in that mushy gray matter between our ears, and that affects and limits and circumscribes how we perceive the world. So he says there's certain things that you just can't get. There's certain things that you simply can't understand because we are trapped down here. That elsewhere the Rambam describes what Olam Haba is like. The world to come is somehow connected to this notion being freed of the body, being freed of the body, being completely disconnected soul, which can plug in, as it were, to knowledge of God, so that you are one with that knowledge. But here we can never fully know God. V'hodio Baruch Hu ma shelo yada Adam lefanav velo yada la'acharav. But nevertheless, Moshe Rabbeinu, because he was the most perfect of all men, but even Moshe Rabbeinu was not without flaw, minor as it may have been, but Moshe Rabbeinu was able to get it. Moses was able to understand God, to know God in ways that none before and none after have yet managed to do. Ad shehesiga, ad shehesig, ma'amitati matzo davar shenifrad HaKadosh Baruch Hu bedato mishar nimtzim kmo she yafrid echad min anashim shirah achara vehesig kol gufo ma'bukshu bedato mishar gufe anashim va'al davar zeh ramaz hakatuv v'amar v'ra'iti et achurai ufanai lo yira'u. That God's response to Moshe, when Moshe asks him, show me, show yourself, God says, you can see me from behind, but my face you can't see. You can see me from behind, meaning I'll give you a glimpse. Again, obviously, we're not speaking literally here. I can give you a glimpse from behind, but you can't see me face to face. You can't see me face to face. Which is not connected to the idea that we say that Moshe spoke to God or God spoke to Moshe panim el panim, face to face. When we say that God spoke to Moshe panim el panim, that's also obviously metaphoric because God doesn't have a face, a literal face. But when we say that God spoke to Moshe panim el panim, it means it was a very direct kind of communication, that Moshe's prophecy was received in a more direct manner than the other prophets. But here, when it says that Moshe can't see God's face, it means that in answer to his question of, I really want to understand you with the same intimacy that I can understand or know, or I can attempt to know someone here, you know, my next door neighbor, my spouse, my child, my father, my mother, God says, no, we can't share that kind of intimacy, that kind of intimate knowledge, because you are you and I am different. Lo machshavotai machshavoteichem, lo derechai derechem. I am different. There are limits to what a human man can understand, can perceive about me, says God. And therefore, it's only like seeing me from behind. That's interesting. It actually resonates something with what I read in that essay by Oliver Sacks, who again suffers from this disorder where he can't differentiate faces, but he says that he to compensate, he gets really, really good at recognizing people by all different types of other things, like their gait, you know, how they walk, how they carry themselves, you know, when they walk, which is something that most of us don't pay attention to because all we need is the face to recognize. But you know, he says he can see somebody walking away, and based upon the way they carry their shoulders or the way they will waddle back and forth, right to left, that he that's how he recognizes them, or he recognizes them by their voice. He says he's much better recognizing people by their voice than the average person as a kind of as a type of way to compensate for his disability. So that's what. That's what Hashem says to Moshe. A little bit you can understand, a little bit you can get it, but not face to face, not directly on. The knowledge of God, which is our task, is always going to be something of a Sisyphean challenge, right? We have to work hard at rolling that rock up the hill, but knowing that we're never going to get all the way because there are limits to what we can know about God in this world. Now, this job that we have to know God, this Tachlit Achat, is the topic of this fifth chapter. Hasagat Hashem, to get God, to chapim, yitpa'er v'yitromeim, kefi yicholet ha'adam, according to human ability. Again, with that disclaimer built in. Ritzoni lomar yediato, to know God. V'yasim pulatav kulan, tnuotav u'menuchatav v'chol diburav, mevi'im el zot ha'tachlit. And now the Rambam introduces another idea, which he hadn't described in the Sefer Mada, at least not in the sections that we saw, that our task in this world, everything that we do down here, should be directed towards this purpose. Now this echoes one of the themes of the fourth chapter, where the Rambam had the lengthy attack on asceticism, where he says, we do not believe that the pleasures of the world are evil. On the contrary, with obviously everything in balance, everything within reason, we embrace the physical world. But now the Rambam says the purpose of embracing the physical world, eating and drinking and having a home and being able to have peace of mind that comes from a certain amount of gashmius, a certain amount of physical comfort, all of that is meant to be harnessed towards achieving the one goal of knowing God. Ad shelo yeh b'pulotav b'shum panim davar mipoal hevel. Ritzoni lomar poal shelo yavi al zot ha'tachlit. But now the Rambam says, however, even though we say eat, drink, enjoy the world, the purpose of enjoying the world is to help us to further the goal of knowing God. And that doesn't mean every bite of the hamburger is going to do that. But as he'll go on to describe, the purpose of our engagement in the world, in the physical world, it's a paradox. There's an irony here. We are limited in our ability to know God completely because, precisely because we are physical beings in a physical world, and that limits our ability to understand something which is completely non-corporeal, completely non-physical, completely not of the world which we inhabit. But our inhabiting of this world, our inhabiting of the physical space, our eating the hamburger is meant to help us further our knowledge of God. That very thing which we can never 100% get because we are hamburger eaters. It's a paradox, it's an irony, but that is what the Rambam is spelling out. It's a difficult task, but it's the one that's placed before us, and what the Rambam will spell out in this much shorter, it's I think less than half the size of the fourth chapter, the fifth chapter, about achieving this one goal. And we will continue this on next week. We will continue this next week. I will try to find you that essay by Sachs, which is really very interesting and more important. Oh, you know what? I can find if you... we're done for the night, as it were, but if anybody wants to hang on, I will just go over to the shelf and find that essay by Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, and I will give you the reference. So I'm not signing off, I'm just going over to the bookshelf, but if you are signing off, we will continue on next Tuesday. Yes, here it is. It's Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, Soloveichik. It's in a volume called Logic of the Heart, Logic of the Mind, Wisdom and Reflections on Topics for Our Time. And it's an essay called... A Glimpse at Eternity from a Hospital Dungeon. It starts on page 30. If somebody's able to Google this and post a link, that would be helpful. He says, okay, I'll email the info, or maybe I'll try to post this essay. He says, I lie in bed in a chamber. Again, the essay is called A Glimpse at Eternity from a Hospital Dungeon. As I lie in bed in a chamber in a hospital dungeon trying to recuperate from the agonizing effects of a stroke that afflicted me, I'm going to take the liberty to give vent to my introspective analysis of my condition. He says, obviously, as a religious person, I've always believed in the existence of a soul extraneous to the body. Secular people, even atheists, also believe in the existence of a soul. However, there is one striking difference between the belief in the existence of a soul entertained by secular people and the belief in the existence of a soul entertained by religious people. And then he says, since the stroke, my belief in the existence of a soul extraneous to the body is not only based upon a religious orientation, but it's something that I am perceiving through my physical senses as a biological sensation. And he goes on to describe, you know, how it's a masterful piece when you consider that he's writing it within days of having a stroke, the kind of reflection that he can undertake under such circumstances is awe-inspiring. I will try to post the essay, and we will continue next week. Oh, is it online? Okay. Very good, Lila Tove.